Yale Club.
What are the rules for a sweater vest? Van Patten asks the table.
What do you mean?
McDermott furrows his brow, takes a sip of absolute.
Yes, I say. Clarify.
Well, is it strictly informal, or can it be worn with a suit? I interrupt, finishing his sentence.
Exactly. He smiles.
Well, according to Bruce Boyer, I begin.
Wait. Van Patten stops me.
Is he with Morgan Stanley?
No, I smile. He's not with Morgan Stanley.
Wasn't he a serial killer?
McDermott asks suspiciously, then moans,
Don't tell me he was another serial killer, Bateman.
Not another serial killer.
No, McDoofus, he wasn't a serial killer, I say, turning back to Van Patten, but before continuing, turn back to McDermott. That really pisses me off.
But you always bring them up, McDermott complains, and always in this casual, educational sort of way. I mean, I don't want to know anything about Son of Sam or the fucking Hillside Strangler or Ted Bundy or Featherhead, for God's sake.
Featherhead? Van Patten asks. Who's Featherhead?
He sounds exceptionally dangerous.
He means Leatherface, I say, teeth tightly clenched.
Leatherface.
He was part of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Oh, Van Patten smiles politely.
Of course.
And he was exceptionally dangerous, I say.
And now, okay, go on. Bruce Boyer.
What did he do? McDermott demands, releasing a sigh, rolling his eyes up.
Let's see. Skin them alive? Starve them to death? Run them over? Feed them to dogs? What?
You guys, I say, shaking my head, then teasingly admit,
he did something far worse.
Like what?
Take them to dinner at McManus's new restaurant? McDermott asks.
That would do it, Van Patten agrees.
Did you go?
It was grubby, wasn't it?
Did you have the meatloaf? McDermott asks.
The meatloaf?
Van Patten's in shock.
What about the interior? What about the fucking tablecloths?
But did you have the meatloaf?
McDermott presses.
Of course I had the meatloaf. And the squab. And the marlin, Van Patten says.
Oh, God, I forgot about the marlin, McDermott groans.
The marlin chili.
After reading Miller's review in the Times, who in their right mind wouldn't order the meatloaf? Or the marlin, for that matter.
But Miller got it wrong, McDermott says.
It was just grubby.
The quesadilla with papaya? Usually a good dish, but there, Jesus.
He whistles, shaking his head.
And cheap, Van Patten adds.
So cheap. McDermott is in total agreement. And the watermelon brittle tart.
Gentlemen,
I cough.
Ahem. I hate to interrupt, but...
Okay, go on, McDermott says.
Tell us more about Charles Moyer.
Bruce Boyer, I correct him.
He was the author of Elegance, A Guide to Quality in Menswear.
Then, as an aside, and no, Craig, he wasn't a serial killer in his spare time.
What did Brucey Baby have to say?
McDermott asks, chewing on ice.
You're a clod. It's an excellent book. His theory remains we shouldn't feel restricted from wearing a sweater vest with a suit, I say.
Did you hear me call you a clod?
Yeah.
But doesn't he point out that a vest shouldn't overpower the suit?
Van Patten offers tentatively.
Yes.
I'm mildly irritated that Van Patten has done his homework, but asks for advice nonetheless.
I calmly continue. With discreet pinstripes, you should wear a subdued blue or charcoal gray vest. A plaid suit would call for a bolder vest.
And remember,
McDermott adds, with a regular vest, the last button should be left undone.
I glance sharply at McDermott. He smiles, sips his drink, and then smacks his lips, satisfied.
Why? Van Patten wants to know.
It's traditional, I say, still glaring at McDermott, but it's also more comfortable.
Will wearing suspenders help the vest sit better? I hear Van Patten ask.
Why? I ask, turning to face him. Well, since you avoid the... He stops, stuck, looking for the right word. Encumbrance of, I begin.
The belt buckle, McDermott finishes.
Sure, Van Patten says. You have to remember... Again, I'm interrupted by McDermott. Remember that while the vest should be in keeping with the color and the style of the suit, completely avoid matching the vest's pattern with your socks or tie, McDermott says, smiling at me, at Van Patten. I thought you hadn't read this book, I stammer angrily. You just told me you couldn't tell the difference between Bruce Boyer and John Wayne Gacy.
He came back to me, he shrugs.
Listen, I turn back to Van Patten, finding McDermott's one-upmanship totally cheap. Wearing Argyle socks with an Argyle vest will look too studied.
You think so? He asks.
You'll look like you consciously work for this look, I say. Then suddenly upset, turn back to McDermott. Featherhead? How in the hell did you get Featherhead from Leatherface?
Ah, cheer up, Bateman, he says, slapping me on the back, then massaging my neck. What's the matter? No shiatsu this morning?
Keep touching me like this, I say, eyes shut tight, entire body wired and ticking, coiled up ready, wanting to spring, and you'll draw back a stump.
Whoa, hold on there, little buddy, McDermott says, backing off in mock fear.
The two of them giggle like idiots and give each other high five, completely unaware that I'd cut his hands off and much more with pleasure. The three of us, David Van Patten, Craig McDermott, and myself, are sitting in the dining room of the Yale Club at lunch. Van Patten is wearing a Glen plaid wool crepe suit from Crizia Uomo, a Brooks Brothers shirt, a tie from Adirondack, and shoes by Cole Haan. McDermott is wearing a lamb's wool and cashmere blazer, worsted wool flannel trousers by Ralph Lauren, a shirt and tie also by Ralph Lauren, and shoes from Brooks Brothers. I'm wearing a tick-weave wool suit with a windowpane overplaid, a cotton shirt by Luciano Barbera, a tie by Luciano Barbera, shoes from Cole Haan, and non-prescription glasses by Bausch & Lomb. The Patty Winters show this morning was about Nazis, and inexplicably, I got a real charge out of watching it. I wasn't exactly charmed by their deeds. I didn't find them unsympathetic either. Nor, I might add, did most of the members of the audience. One of the Nazis, in a rare display of humor, even juggled grapefruits, and delighted, I sat up in bed and clapped. Louis Carruthers sits five tables away from this one, dressed as if he had done some kind of frog attack this morning. He's wearing an unidentifiable suit from some French tailor, and if I'm not mistaken, the bowler hat on the floor beneath his chair also belongs to him. It has Louis written all over it. He smiles, but I pretend not to have noticed. I worked out at Exclusive for 2 hours this morning, and since the three of us have taken the rest of the afternoon off, we're all getting massages. We haven't ordered yet. In fact, we haven't even seen menus. We've just been drinking. A bottle of champagne is what Craig originally wanted, but David shook his head vehemently and said, "Out, out, out," when this was suggested. And so we ordered drinks instead. I keep watching Louis, and whenever he looks over at our table, I tip my head back and laugh, even if what Van Patten or McDermott's saying isn't particularly funny, which is practically always. I perfected my fake response to a degree where it's so natural-sounding that no one notices. Louis stands up, wipes his mouth with a napkin, and glances over here again before exiting the dining area, and I'm supposing goes to the men's room. But there's a limit, Van Patten is saying. The point is, I don't want to spend the evening with a cookie monster. But you're still dating Meredith, so what's the difference? I ask. Naturally, he doesn't hear. But Ditzy is cute, McDermott says. Ditzy is very cute. Bateman? Van Patten asks. Any style opinions on ditziness? What? I ask, getting up.
Ditzy.
No?
McDermott this time. Ditzy's desirable. Comprende?
Listen, I say, pushing my chair in. I just want everyone to know that I'm pro-family and anti-drug. Excuse me. As I walk away, Van Patten grabs a passing waiter and says, his voice fading, Is this tap water? I don't drink tap water. Bring me an Evian or something, okay? Would Courtney like me less if Lewis was dead? This is the question I have to face, with no clear answer burning back across my mind, as I make my way slowly through the dining room, waving to someone who looks like Vincent Morrison, someone else who I'm fairly sure is someone who looks like Tom Newman. Would Courtney spend more time with me, the time she now spends with Lewis, if he was out of the picture, no longer an alternative, if he was perhaps dead? If Lewis were killed, would Courtney be upset? Could I genuinely be of comfort without laughing in her face, my own spite doubling back on me, giving everything away? Is the fact that she dates me behind his back what excites her? My body or the size of my dick? Why, for that matter, do I want to please Courtney? If she likes me only for my muscles, the heft of my cock, then she's a shallow bitch. But a physically superior, near-perfect-looking shallow bitch, and that can override anything except maybe bad breath or yellow teeth, either of which is a real deal-breaker. Would I ruin things by strangling Lewis? If I married Evelyn, would she make me buy her LaCroix gowns until we finalized our divorce? Have the South African colonial forces and the Soviet-backed black guerrillas found peace yet in Namibia? Or would the world be a safer, kinder place if Lewis was hacked to bits? My world might. So why not? There really is no other hand. It's really even too late to be asking these questions, since now I'm in the men's room, staring at myself in the mirror, tan and haircut perfect, checking out my teeth, which are completely straight and white and gleaming. Winking at my reflection, I breathe in, sliding on a pair of leather Armani gloves, and then make my way toward the stall Lewis occupies. The men's room is deserted. All the stalls are empty, except for the one at the end. The door is not locked, left slightly ajar. The sound of Lewis whistling something from Les Miserables, getting almost oppressively louder as I approach. He's standing in the stall, his back to me, wearing a cashmere blazer, pleated wool trousers, a cotton silk white shirt, pissing into the toilet. He can tell he senses movement in the stall because he stiffens noticeably, and the sound of his urine hitting water stops abruptly in midstream. In slow motion, my own heavy breathing blocking out all other sounds, my vision blurring slightly around the edges, my hands move up over the collar of his cashmere blazer and cotton flannel shirt, circling his neck until my thumbs meet at the nape, and my index fingers touch each other just above Lewis's Adam's apple. I start to squeeze, tightening my grip, but it's loose enough to let Lewis turn around, still in slow motion, so he can stand facing me, one hand over his wool and silk polo sweater, the other hand reaching up. His eyelids flutter for an instant, then widen, which is exactly what I want. I want to see Lewis's face contort and turn purple, and I want him to know who it is who's killing him. I want to be the last face, the last thing that Lewis sees before he dies, and I want to cry out, I'm fucking Courtney. Do you hear me? I'm fucking Courtney. And have these be the last words, the last sounds he hears, until his own gurglings, accompanied by the crunching of his trachea, drown everything else out. Lewis stares at me, and I tense the muscles in my arms, preparing myself for a struggle that, disappointingly, never comes. Instead, he looks down at my wrists and for a moment wavers, as if he's undecided about something, and then he lowers his head and kisses my left wrist. And when he looks back up at me, shyly, it's with an expression that's loving and only part awkward. His right hand reaches up and tenderly touches the side of my face. I stand there, frozen, my arms still stretched out in front of me, fingers still circled around Lewis's throat. God, Patrick, he whispers, why here? His hand is playing with my hair now. I look over at the side of the stall, where someone has scratched into the paint, Edwin Gibbs' marvelous head. and I'm still paralyzed in this position and gazing at the words, confused, studying the frame surrounding the words as if that contained an answer, a truth. Edwin? Edwin who? I shake my head to clear it and look back at Lewis, who has this horrible, love-struck grin plastered on his face. And I try to squeeze harder, my face twisted with exertion. But I can't do it. My hands won't tighten, and my arms still stretched out look ludicrous and useless in their fixed position. "I've seen you looking at me," he says, panting. "I've noticed your..." He gulps. "Hot body." He tries to kiss me on the lips, but I back away, into the stall door, accidentally closing it. I drop my hands from Lewis's neck, and he takes them and immediately places them back. I drop them once again and stand there contemplating my next move, but I'm immobile.
"Don't be shy," he says.
I take a deep breath, close my eyes, count to 10, open them, and make a helpless attempt to lift my arms back up to strangle Lewis, but they feel weighed down, and lifting them becomes an impossible task.
"You don't know how long I've wanted it."
He's sighing, rubbing my shoulders, trembling.
"Ever since that Christmas party at Arizona 206, you know the one, you were wearing that red striped paisley Armani tie."
For the first time I notice his pants are still unzipped, and calmly and without difficulty, I turn out of the stall and move over to a sink to wash my hands, but my gloves are still on, and I don't want to take them off. The bathroom at the Yale Club suddenly seems to be the coldest room in the universe, and I shudder involuntarily. Lewis trails behind, touching my jacket, leaning next to me at the sink.
"I want you,"
he says in a low, faggoty whisper. And when I slowly turn my head to glare at him, while hunched over the sink, seething, my eye contact radiating revulsion, he adds,
"Two."
I storm out of the men's room, bumping into Brewster Whipple, I think. I smile at the maitre d', and after shaking his hand, I make a run for the closing elevator, but I'm too late, and I cry out, pounding a fist against the doors, cursing, composing myself. I notice the maitre d' conferring with a waiter, the two of them looking my way questioningly, and so I straighten up, smile shyly, and wave at them. Lewis strides over calmly, still grinning, flushed. I just stand there and let him walk up to me. He says nothing.
"What is it?"
I finally hiss.
"Where are you going?"
he whispers, bewildered. I've got a..." Stumped, I look around the crowded dining room, then back at Lewis's quivering, yearning face. "I've got to return some videotapes," I say, jabbing at the elevator button. Then, my patience shot, I start to walk away and head back toward my table.
"Patrick!"
he calls out. I whirl around.
"What?"
he mouths.
"I'll call you."
With this expression on his face, it lets me know that assures me my secret is safe with him.
"Oh, my God,"
I practically gag, and shaking visibly, I sit back at our table, completely defeated, my gloves still on, and gulp down the rest of a watery J&B on the rocks. As soon as I've seated myself, Van Patten asks,
"Hey, Bateman, what's the right way to wear a tie bar or clasp?"
"While a tie holder is by no means required business wear, it adds to a clean, neat overall appearance. But the accessory shouldn't dominate the tie. Choose a simple gold bar or a small clip, and place it at the lower end of the tie at a downward 45-degree angle.